Ancient alien ancestors. Up next, Will Hart's with us with an incredible story on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Will Hart, a journalist, a photographer, filmmaker, author, has a deep and abiding interest in natural and human history. His work has been published in Wild West, Sierra Heritage, Adventure West, Nexus, New Dawn, and more. His articles have appeared in every issue of Atlantis Rising for the past several years, and he's just agreed to write a column for New Dawn. A couple of his books include Alien Civilizations and Ancient Alien Ancestors. Will, welcome to the program, my friend.
Well, thank you, and it's great to be back on with you, George.
Time flies by when you're having fun, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
You're still in Mexico these days?
Yes, I am. I'm still in Mexico. I'm doing research down here. I've been doing it long term. As you know, things keep popping up in central Mexico, there at Teotihuacan, new findings. And Mexico's a great place. I mean, there's so many enigmas down here that I think I need to go anywhere else. I'll be going to Japan here pretty soon, actually.
Okay, you keep in touch with us. There was a report today, Will, that the asteroid that hit into Yucatan that wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago created darkness for at least 2 years around the planet. Isn't that unbelievable?
Yeah, it would. I can see how that would happen, yeah. Really? That would be a tremendous impact.
Tell me about your work.
If you don't mind, I would like to actually start by bringing up the pioneer in this field, the ancient astronaut field, which has turned into ancient aliens, but it's the same thing. And that is Eric von Däniken, the pioneer who's still at it, as you know. And he's just done, he blazed the trail here. And now with the Ancient Aliens TV show also, I'd like to give a shout out to them, because I think they've really maintained the interest and even increased the interest, because when I published my first book, it was really kind of struggling. You know, the whole field was actually in a kind of a sideways mode, and now I find that many, many people now throughout society are interested.
No, you're right. People are getting it now, and I think the television show had a lot to do with that.
Yes, I agree. It really did, and I know you've been part of it. So that's great. You've got a very good two venues to put the word out, and you've been doing it. So I appreciate all the people in this that are doing it.
Well, how did you get interested in the subject matter?
Well, it goes back to Mexico, and it goes back to Eric von Däniken, and I read his books when they came out. You and I are, the same generation.
Mm-hmm.
And back there in the early 70s when it came out, I read it. I got very interested, and I decided to do a complete tour of Mexico and see for myself. Look at these things up close and personal, study, go to every museum. I went to every major site all around the country. And I must say, and the Olmec heads had me very intrigued and asking questions, because there are many mysteries about it. Those heads were quarried 70 miles from where they ended up, in mountains, and, the people, whoever did it, had to carry them, transport them from the mountains 70 miles through a jungle. Nobody can explain how they did that. Archaeologists don't try. The basalt heads are, that's hard to work. That's a hard stone to work, and where are the tools that did it? And those kind of questions had me thinking, like Eric was thinking, that these are very strange to find here. Why are they African in appearance? Why do they have helmets on? What's the import of this? But then as I traveled around, a lot of the sites I didn't find, to me just didn't say alien right off. Until I made the whole circuit around the country and came back to Teotihuacan, first time I visited. When I got there, I was completely stunned. When I walked, climbed up the pyramids and stood there and looked out over that whole vast, the valley there, and you see that there were hundreds, the place is just unimaginably complicated. And it looks like some kind of a circuit board, it was so meticulously laid out. And when I found the mica was up sandwiched into the top layer of the pyramid, and then at a so-called temple, I just think it was a room, there was also mica, and a room full of mica underneath the floor. That just totally, I must say, blew me away, because mica, you know what the use is today. I mean, it's an insulator, electrical, heat insulator, you know, radiation, so on. I mean, that's what it's for. So I just thought, I'm looking at something here that is that really, really needs some serious study.
Right. Somebody a long time ago knew what that was for, and that is way beyond any technology we could have imagined then.
That's right, and that's very true. And now that they found the mercury underneath the temple of Quetzalcoatl, that then, you know, it starts to connect the dots. You know, here you have mica, which is an insulator, and mercury, which is a good conductor. And we found mercury in China as well. And in the Hindu, in their ancient texts about the Vimanas, they used mercury to propel them. So these connections are starting to come now to where it's starting to make more sense. We don't just have little pieces, you know, that are just hanging out there disconnected. The whole field now, to me, is it's getting very scientific now. We've compiled so much evidence. And I just hope the public can keep up with it, because it's everything is changing very fast.
It is fast, and it's coming at them, the public, in a rapid fashion. But they've got to be able to digest it. But I think they have the capability, Will. I think people really understand this. They grasp it. They want it more so than years ago. I think they can handle it.
Yeah, I agree. And I had a long high. It wasn't a hiatus, really. I was doing a lot of deep research, and I decided that unless I really had something to say, to really add, and some discoveries, I wasn't going to publish another book until I did. And that's what happened. I made a couple of discoveries that are in this book, and they're profound. One of them especially, I think, can be a game changer. It takes a while, though, to wrap your mind around it. When it first came to me, I was kind of in a state of shock, and it's taken a few years. And I agree with you, though. You and I have been at this a long time, and it's quite a bit different than people who are just coming new to it.
Right.
They must feel flooded.
Oh, my gosh. But, you know, I was approached today from someone who saw your name on our website. I'm here in St. Louis right now, Will. And and he came up to me and says, oh, my gosh, I can't wait to listen to this program. And this was somebody who was in his 20s. And, you know, you wouldn't think they'd be into it as much as they were, but he was. That's exciting.
Yeah, it is. I agree. The younger people, and especially researchers, younger researchers, and I've been running across a few now who are very sharp, who are very good, and they get it. That's good to see. You know, Eric von Däniken and you and I, we're moving along here and doing our job, but if the younger generation doesn't pick up the baton, then what?
Exactly.
And I'm seeing it now.
Well, let's go even back further, not only from that area in Mexico and Central America, but let's go to Egypt for a second. You've looked there too, haven't you?
Yes. My research into Egypt, well, you know, it's been extensive. I'm not an archaeologist, though. Maybe we need to go over that point, because I think a lot of people get confused. And when archaeologists attack Eric von Däniken or Graham Hancock or somebody like me, my response is, I'm not an archaeologist. I'm an independent historian. Mm-hmm. And each of us has the right to be an independent historian. None of us has the right to go conduct archaeological excavations unless we have a license. But you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
There's an important distinction there. Because how we interpret this history that we're given, the pieces that archaeologists and historians and anthropologists give us, it's up to us to interpret it.
Well, there's no question about that. And when you look at the pyramids of Giza, for example, Any great building has to have had some kind of archaeological sketching or something for planning. You just don't throw blocks together, especially,
The Great Pyramid, the thing about it, what I found, just so that, because I want to nail it down to people, why is it that I say the Egyptians could not have built the Great Pyramid? Well, I'll tell you why. Because it was precision engineered. The Egyptians had no precision engineering. And archaeologists use circular logic. They say, well, there the Great Pyramid is, and all we know is the Egyptians were there, so they must have built it, and they must have been sophisticated. No, they weren't. We know what their tools are. They're in the museum. They're very primitive.
That's right.
They claim that they use round hammer stones to make these incredibly sophisticated artifacts with sharp right angles, diorite statues that are perfectly smooth that you can't create by hand. You can't do it. And the Great Pyramid, the engineering forensic engineering firm, International, it's got like four names to it, Smith, Johnson, and so on, was brought in by Egyptologists to study, analyze, and give their assessment of the Great Pyramid. The first thing they said was, the base is so level, we would achieve it today using lasers.
Jeez.
Well, how could people, surveyors called rope stretchers in Egypt, have done such a thing with workers using round hammer stones on 13 acres of a very rugged, uneven, the plateau out there, the Giza. The whole scenario, you just keep looking at it and go, why do we have these, why are we accepting these silly proposals when our common sense tells us, no, this couldn't have been done this way. Nobody did that, could make a 48-story precision-engineered building with these primitive tools.
It's impossible.
Yeah, it's utterly impossible. And I think part of what our job is, right, is to convince people, just use your common sense.
Even if, Will, time was a factor here, and the argument was many thousands of people and workers. They throw numbers and time at it, and that still doesn't mean perfection. And I, you know what? Nobody has explained to me how they could move blocks, and I don't, agree with the theory that they put them on wooden rollers and pulled these things. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, my counter to, they always go to the, how you transported them across the ground. What I go to is lifting. You show me, you take a 70-ton block, which is 28 feet long, that are up in the King's Chamber, the granite blocks that are in the King's Chamber. That's 150 vertical feet off the ground. They had to get these 70-ton blocks. First, you had to quarry it. The problem with when they throw numbers, and ropes, and they're pulling it across the sand is one thing. When you try to lift, you get a limited number of men positioned around the stone, and they cannot possibly lift 70 tons.
we don't even have cranes that could do that.
Yeah, our mobile cranes, we might have a few now, but hey, we're 5,000 years into civilization. We ought to be able to do those things. We're looking back at people who, they didn't have anything for technology. They had nothing. They didn't even have the wheel. I don't know if people realize how primitive the Egyptians were in the Old Kingdom. They didn't have the wheel. They didn't have bronze. They didn't have dray animals, no beasts of burden. So, they say, we had slaves. 10,000 people, they can do it. No, they can't. The physics, you can only position so many men along a 28-foot, maybe 12 or 13 on one side and on the other. They can't lift 70 tons, ever, and they never did. And that my challenge, and it's in the book, my challenge to archaeologists is quit saying these stupid things that are just confusing the public and prove it. That is scientific. Right there, you can hold an experiment and prove it. All you need is men and a big block of stone. Show us that they can lift it, and we'll believe you. If you can't do it, and of course they won't, they will never try that ever.
What do you think?
We never try to prove. So we're in this game, and it's not science, it's politics, right?
That's right, exactly. What do you think the purpose?
Academic politics is strangling this whole thing, and it's up to the public to start telling them, we're not buying your nonsense anymore.
What do you think the purpose? Well, what's the purpose of the Great Pyramids? What do you think? Christopher Dunn thinks they were power sources.
I agree with Dunn in terms of, I think it was a machine, an operating machine at one point. I don't think when he parallels it to the way we generate electricity, I don't think they were generating electricity. I think it was subtler than that. I think they were using ELF, or extremely low frequency energy, and not because I don't see any evidence that there was any download devices anywhere. And even Tesla's wireless energy tower, mm-hmm. you were going to have a download device. You had to.
Yeah.
And I don't see why it would be any different. I think that it was generating energy, and we're not quite there to understand the technology because we keep looking through the lens of our own technology, right? We keep projecting like, oh, it's got to be like this. Well, no, it doesn't have to be like anything we're doing. And if you look at the Great Pyramid and study it, everything that made it workable was dismantled, was taken out of it. And then it was plugged up. Whoever did it didn't really want anybody who came along after them to know exactly what they were doing. It was hermetically sealed. Everything that was in the Grand Gallery was taken out. There was a lot of damage inside of it. You couldn't make it workable again. And we're sitting here trying to unpuzzle it, and it just doesn't seem like we can do it. I don't think it had one purpose. I think it had many. And that's my assessment of it. The other thing that, I don't know if we want to bring it up here or not, but the discovery I made was one of the purposes of the Great Pyramid, it is the GPS anchor of the planet.
Now, you explain that.
Okay. Basically, you know that there's a 30 degree north, right? The 30 degree north latitude, the Great Pyramid sits just below it. Abu Rosh is actually right on it.
Okay.
But many, then you go to the east, and what you find is the city of Ur, the Sumerian city is right on 30. You keep going, you find that Harappa, which was the Indus Valley civilization city, is right on the 30 north. That Lhasa Tibet is right on it. And you keep going around, and the other thing you find with it is, though, that the Nile, the mouth of the Nile, the delta, is right on 30 north. So the deltas of all these major rivers, including all the way around to the Yangtze, and then on the other side, the Mississippi River, are right on 30 north. When I realized that, that gives you the key that, okay, they're showing you the actual geometry of the planet. We screwed it up, we screwed ourselves up, and not seeing the geometry of the planet by making Greenwich. See, that threw it up, because Greenwich is not the natural longitude. Right? Greenwich is, the Great Pyramid sits right on it, and all those pyramids, and the Nile goes right along a longitude line that goes down to the equator.
Now, there's got to be a significance to this, a purpose, right?
Well, I think it shows the geometry. You know, is Earth. Geometry is the kind of the logical layout of the planet, and there is one. The mouth of the Mississippi River is exactly 120 degrees from the mouth of the Nile. That's a significant geometrical figure.
It's also strange. Stay with us, Will. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and chat more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Will Hart with us. His latest book is Ancient Alien Ancestors, about advanced technologies. Let's get back into this 30 north latitude. I find this to be fascinating, Will. Not being an architect, of course, but tell me more about this.
Well, you have to kind of approach it and ask questions like the geology of the planet. Why would these rivers terminate from the landmass to seas and to, like, take for instance the Mississippi River comes to the Gulf of Mexico on 30 North. That's exactly where New Orleans is on 30 North, and that's where the Delta is. Well, the same thing with the Nile. Well, the same thing with the Tigris-Euphrates. Well, the same thing with the Yangtze. Why would these rivers terminate? Because we geologists tell us this is all kind of, they know what the processes are, you know, erosion and deposition and so on. But nobody thinks of it in terms of how did this organization happen where everything, these land masses terminate and rivers go into the seas around this same band around the Earth, exact same band around the Earth in the Northern Hemisphere. It's just it's a very deep question. Nobody has the answer for that. I would just speculate, theoretically, that the Earth was terraformed, and the Great Pyramid is showing us. It's one of the indicators, one of the signatures of the race that did it, that when we get to the level where we can understand this stuff, that look around, this has all been planned out. This has all been engineered. You're not just in some random mess here. That's how I read it, and that's what I mean. Partly one step, and that's a big step, theoretically. Are scientists I don't think they'll even ask questions for a long time.
And with it being terraformed, of course, it could also have been seeded, right?
Absolutely. And that's the theory. That's why I don't just approach this through archaeology. I approach it through science. I approach it through directed panspermia and panspermia, which is just what you're saying, the theories that life is out there everywhere in the universe, and planets get seeded when the time is right, and that's what happened to the Earth. More scientists now are taking panspermia seriously, that it gets delivered by meteorites and whatever. Directed panspermia, Sir Francis Crick, the eminent, the late microbiologist who came up with the shape of DNA, he proposed in about the same time Eric von Däniken was making his proposal that an advanced alien civilization seeded the Earth. That was a better explanation than evolution or anything that scientists have come up with so far. And he knew what he was talking about. He understood DNA. I mean, he just understood, you know, he was a very good scientist. So I've been studying that alongside this archaeology the whole time, and I'm looking. See, that theory predicts exactly what space science has found. You and I go back there in the 60s and 70s when scientists were saying, oh, there's nothing out there. Those planets are all dry. There's no water out there. Well, then when they got out there, what have they found? They found water all over the place. Well, that indicated where there's water, there's life. And they're finding it out way out in interstellar space. There's the signature of water. So now, you know, the doors are opening on both sides. It's not just, you know, the Great Pyramid, and it's not just the Sumerians or the Anunnaki. It's hard science that's showing, look, there's the indications. Meteorites have come to Earth with, you know, the signature of life, life on them. All the ingredients for life are there on these meteorites that are flying around in space.
It's everywhere.
That's right. And we're just coming to that point now to realize, coming out of our shell, you know, that no, Earth is not the only planet with intelligent life on it. It's out there all over the place. It's just very spread out.
You've looked at, Will, also the prospects of UFOs, Roswell. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on those.
Well, one of my goals, objectives with this book was to kind of break down the partition between the ancient alien theorists and modern UFO researchers. Because there's been a kind of a partition there where we're not really talking, you know.
Right.
I think we're talking about a continuum. This phenomena has been with humanity ever since when? And Ezekiel pointed it out, and we've had, you know, Moses at Mount Sinai, and they pointed these things out way back, you know, many thousands of years ago, that they were dealing with a phenomenon they didn't understand at all, because they didn't even know what a machine was. They used the best language they could, and then, you know, paradoxically, we call UFOs flying saucers, so we should understand that they were talking in metaphors. They weren't talking about a cloud up in the sky. That's all they knew that was up in the sky was a cloud or birds. But something strange was up in the sky. Well, we don't know what it is. Call it a cloud. You know what I'm saying? This stuff is a lot simpler if you just make a simple shift in your perceptions, you know, and understand ancient humans, you know, and what limitations they had. And it's time to reinterpret this stuff. The entire Old Testament is a very good document on terraforming, on bioengineering, on how things got going on this planet. It's time to come out of fantasy land, you know.
Why did they keep
in for thousands of years?
Why the cover-up, Will? Why not tell us what happened at Roswell and all these other things? You've looked at the UFOs buzzing the nation's capital back in 52.
Yeah, Roswell's probably the key. You know, that first there was the little-known battle over L.A.,
right,
which happened during World War II, right in Los Angeles, and tens of thousands of people saw it, and they, you know, got the artillery out there and fired round after round at this object that was hovering, that was just sitting there for everybody to see, and the shells just bounced off and did nothing.
Right, and you could hear the pinging, right?
Yeah, and they, you know, the shells fell back, and they were on the beaches, and some people got hurt, and it alarmed everybody. But here's what happened: it just went away because the war was the important thing, and it went on, and there were no UFO investigation, you know, no organizations that were doing that. People were unaware of the phenomena, and it just took everybody by storm, and then it went away. People forgot about it, and so even took a long time, and actually the internet, to bring it back to people's attention. That was the first one, and then Roswell came, but people were alerted to that by the military. And to me, that's a fascinating, the whole thing about Roswell and the appearance of UFOs in New Mexico then. Of course, you know, the atomic bomb was built in New Mexico. It was tested in New Mexico, not far from Roswell.
Alamogordo.
That's right. That's right. And then you have the base right there. Well, that was the base that dropped, you know, it was those pilots that dropped the bombs on Japan. So it was all tied together with this whole new atomic era that we got into, and now the UFOs show up in pretty large numbers in New Mexico, and there were a lot of, you know, news media stuff going on down there. Roswell, to me, I break it down a little differently. Some of the strongest evidence to me, of course, when the military came out with the positive, you know, we have a flying saucer. We have, you know, you have an intelligence officer analyzing it out there. He knew what he was doing.
Which they really made him switch pretty darn fast, right?
Well, you know how it is. He didn't have much choice.
No.
The politics of military, you just don't fool around.
He was ordered to do it.
That's right. Sure, he was ordered. And the orders came down from the top. Now, a couple of the giveaways to me of what actually happened was, that's Jesse Marcel, right? Jesse Marcel, after he went along with the program, was promoted and sent to the Pentagon, and he had special duty after that. Blanchard, the guy, the captain of the base, went on to become the highest ranking. He reached the highest rank. Now, these guys had been good soldiers, and they went on with it. You don't, now, if they had botched things as the military climbed and seen a weather balloon, would they have been promoted?
No way. As a matter of fact, the collision of the United States destroyer, the commander today was relieved of his duties. So if you screw up in the military, you're out.
Yeah, and they didn't screw up at all. You know, they saw what they saw. They reported the original, you know, story was the truth. Well, we don't know exactly up the chain decided, and we could guess, right? We can speculate just logically. The powers that be looked at it. They had the technology. They came to a pretty quick assessment. You know what? We can back engineer this. We can come up with technologies of our own out. And the U.S. did. The fact is, very soon after that, the U.S. started coming up with a lot of technology and kind of leaped ahead of the rest of the world. Well, once they made the decision, though, to put the lid on it, they've stuck by it ever since. They're not going to backtrack. And that was very political, and so the U.S. has been frozen there ever since, you know, with this kind of taint around UFOs, and either it's silly or it makes you uncomfortable or whatever. Yeah, other countries, like down here in Mexico, people talk openly about it. They accept UFOs. And the government does. They opened their files years ago. But the U.S. is under this cloud with that particular topic because the government put the clamp on.
Let's talk a little bit, Will, about this nuclear age and how the UFOs started really starting to appear, even though they were visiting us, you know, for centuries gone back. But do you think it was the nuke era that really got them coming?
Yeah, I do. Because we kind of punched through into another dimension.
Yeah. We joined the club. We joined the club, didn't we?
Yeah, and then it looks to me like, okay, we came under, you know, more like stringent monitoring, like what's going on and how much do they really know? And you know, they've shut bases down, too. They've shut some of our missile bases down just to kind of show the military that, you know, we can lock this thing down on you if we choose to.
Yep.
And a lot of people don't know these things, you know, and that to me is a good thing, right? I mean, if we get out of control, I would like to know that there's somebody more intelligent above us who can go, no, you're not going to do that. Now we're going to step in. You lost your free will here. We got revoked temporarily on this one. That's fine with me. I don't think we should be allowed to destroy ourselves and the planet. It's not really ours. You know, we're part of a much, to me, my theory is that we're part of a human race that has many branches to it. Like we can talk about the elongated skull. You know, that's another part of the branch.
Mm-hmm.
They were more intelligent than us. They taught us a lot of these things. The leaders of Egypt had elongated skulls. The Paracas, the people in Peru had elongated skulls. Those are not head bind. You know, that didn't come from binding an infant's head up. We know that the structure is different. The DNA is different. And our, you know, no woman came up with the idea, well, I think I'm just going to wrap my baby's head up and squish it to make it a different shape. What tribe is going to go along with that? Unless they were modeling what they thought was a superior race. And, they probably were.
You've looked at the original Mercury 7 astronauts, our early astronauts in our space program. What do you think happened during those eras? Did they see things?
Yes, they did. Sure they did. Those guys are not going to lie about that. And when they spoke out, especially, I think Gordon Cooper was really the most vocal and articulate about it. And he had some experiences which he related and said, basically, you know, they confiscated his photos. And he was mad about it. You could tell. He was mad. And he wanted the public to know, you know, what he'd seen. And he didn't like the fact that the government, you know, had him under the thumb. And he decided to speak up. Some of the other ones have spoken out too. Yes, they saw things out there. There's no doubt about it. They wouldn't. You remember the era. People think that NASA just came up, you know, was talking about space and science. That wasn't all there was to it. Throughout the 50s, there were UFO waves. They were in the newspaper. They were on people's minds. What are these things? That was part of it. If you remember, that was part of the whole thing. It got NASA going. It was, you know, it wasn't just the race with Russia and all that, which is a whole other issue. Is there something out there? You know, and then when they saw it, there you go back to Roswell again. NASA put the clamp on it. They never say there's, right? They never said there are no UFOs. U.S. government has never said that. The media has implied it for many years, but the government itself has never come out in black and white and said there's no UFOs. They said there was no security risk from these, whatever they are.
The fact that the fact that they've never come out directly to deny it, they just kind of swept it under the carpet.
Yeah, you know, the original investigation they did back in the late 40s turned out positive. They flat out said, yeah, these are from elsewhere. These machines are not from the Earth, and so on. Well, somebody in Washington decided to reverse it. They quickly came out with Project Grudge, which turned around and said, no, there's nothing. So, you know, they've kept it ambiguous the whole time. Then, you know, in recent years, the CIA released a lot of their photos, and you can see the UFOs there. So we have this ambiguity in it, you know, and really the truth is people have to make up their own minds. Don't wait for somebody to tell you. You got to make up. You got to do enough research and homework to come to the conclusion, because you're going to constantly get conflicting opinions.
Will, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back at the top of the hour and take phone calls with you next. Will Hart, his latest book, of course, is called Ancient Alien Ancestors. And we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.